Welcome to When Blue Turns Black, a rare and fascinating exploration of true crime. Join former police officer Vonnie T as she reveals intimate details of her career, explores the psychological toll crime can have with others, and shares her own experience with PTSD.
In this episode, I'm going to talk about a job that I attended when I worked at Gundawindi. It was an armed holdup at the Railway Hotel. It occurred at about 1:20 a.m. on the 23rd of February 2013. Now, at that time, I was working a 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. shift with Constable Kyle Gorkic. Just so you know, I've recently spoken with Kyle. He's no longer in the Queensland Police Service, and he's given me consent to use his name. Makes the job a bit easier for me. So if you hear me refer to Gork, that's who I'm talking about. So we'd had a pretty, I wouldn't say quiet shift, you know, just a few things going on here and there. And then about, I think it was about midnight that night, we attended a traffic accident. It was a bit of a weird one, and it had a weird vibe and an odd feeling to it right from the start. The driver had apparently decamped or run off on foot prior to us attending. There were other persons or occupants of that vehicle that were there at the time. So we weren't sure if it was one of them that had actually done the, you know, had the accident and was driving, or if it was in fact someone else. So we had to make further inquiries. So at that time, we grabbed the occupants, we took them back to the police station, and we were conducting inquiries with them as to what had gone on. Now, we were doing this separately because obviously you don't want to have everyone sitting in a room and listening to what each other is saying. So I was down one end of the police station talking with one of the occupants, and Gork was up the other. At that time, about 1:20, maybe it was, you know, several minutes after, we received information via the police radio that there was an armed holdup at the Railway Hotel. Initially, I sort of thought, the pub shut over an hour ago, so I don't understand how there's an armed holdup there, except for maybe someone on premises with any staff that were there, like after closing. So I clarified with police comms. Now, the information that they then provided was that there was staff there after close. They were counting up the pokey money and doing their end of shift close as they normally do. When three occupants had stormed in and had attempted to take the staff hostage and take the pokey's money. At this stage, one of the staff members had managed to flee and had run outside. The offenders had tried to chase this person and were unable to catch them. So at this point in time, I've gone and grabbed Gork and said, mate, we've got to go. We've got an armed holdup. And he was down the other end of the station. I'm not sure if he had his radio on. I was right near the where the police radio was in the station, so I heard it. He was a bit like, oh, well, what do I do with these people? I'm like, mate, we boot them out. We've got their details. We'll make these inquiries later. This job, this traffic accident, is less important than an armed holdup. So we booted those people out of the station. We put on our bulletproof vests, jumped in the car, and off we went. The police station isn't very far from the Railway Hotel. It's actually on the same street. So I didn't even bother to put the lights and sirens on. I just drove pretty quick up the road. I didn't want to alert them to the fact that we were en route. Whilst we were en route, I received information that one of the offenders had what the informant thought was a shotgun. So this sort of changed things in my mind. They were definitely armed at this point in time. Well, that's the information that was provided by the person who had run off. And this person was apparently, you know, very fearful for their life, as you would be. So I drove up Herbert Street and I stopped and parked the vehicle probably about maybe 100 metres away, you know, maybe further. I just found a spot where there was no street lighting and the police vehicle wouldn't be lit up too much, and parked. We got out and we walked up. So I'll just quickly explain about the Railway Hotel. It's actually on the intersection of Herbert Street and Railway Parade. The pub part itself is on the corner. On Herbert Street, you can access a drive-through that goes behind the building And then it sort of does like a, it does a like a turn that goes back towards Railway Parade. And that's how you get back out. You exit it on Railway Parade. Now, on that, in that drive-through, when you go to exit, there's also a hotel, a motel side there. It's just a big long building, as most motels are, and it's a part of the pub as well. So it was a hotel motel. And they quite regularly had people staying at the motel, and they'd eat and, you know, have a few drinks at the pub. A lot of workmen would stay there as well. So we walked in through that bottle-o. We kept our heads down. The aim was to get to the motel section as soon as we could, where we could find cover behind the vehicles that were parked there. There was a lot of four-wheel drives. And also so that I could get to where one of the informants were. So what had happened en route, we also received information that there was a male in the hotel who was staying there, and he had been on the phone with police communications as he had witnessed some of the incident and was providing information as to whether or not he thought that the offenders were still inside the hotel. So we've snuck on up in front of the vehicles that were parked there, gone and knocked on the door of the unit or the motel room that this gentleman was staying in. Now, he was pretty apprehensive about opening the door. We've gone in, had a quick conversation with him, and then we've come back out. So the information was he was unsure at this point in time. He tried to keep our eyes on the door where the offenders had entered. However, there were several other exits due to it being on a corner. So at this stage, we're still unsure if there was any offenders inside. We believe that they had been because it had been a pretty quick response. Communications also had. So we advised communications of what we were doing. We've then gone to triangulate. So what we've done is we've come out of the motel. We've walked over to the entrance where the offenders have gone in. This was an area where a lot of people would smoke, what was a smoking, designated smoking area. And then when you walk back through that door, you went straight pretty much into the pokey section. And then if you continued walking through that pokey section, through the hallway, you would come out into the dining area of the pub, and just past the dining area was the kitchen. So that doorway, you could pretty much see straight through. So we've come up to that doorway. The door was open, and we were, like I said, we triangulated as we came up to the doorway just in case someone was there. When we got to the doorway and in, we walked in just a little bit, and I could see that there was money from the pokey machines just laying all over the floor. There was cash tins everywhere, and I was like, holy shit, this is real. It has occurred here. We heard a door flapping and saw like over near the kitchen area, and suddenly I just thought, they're still here. They're definitely here. And I hope to God that they haven't heard us. We've tried to be really quiet. In that split second, I thought for 1 second, I hope I make it home to my daughter tonight, because I realize that a Glock has nothing on a shotgun. And that was the information that we were provided at the time. We hadn't seen the offenders. We hadn't been able to speak to anyone other than the male in the motel unit. And so that was the information that we had received. It was eerie, and this silence just overcame me for a second. I thought at that point in time that I had just, that was a thought going through my mind. Gork said to me later on that I mouthed those words. I said, I hope I get home to see my daughter tonight. Now, this gave him a fright too. He wasn't sure if they were in there. You know, neither of us were. I looked at him and I said, mate, we're just going to retreat. We're going to go back out. There's no way that I'm going to walk in here, because they're probably just going to ambush us. And, you know, they've got the upper hand. They can see us. We're blind. We don't know what's going on. So we backed out. Walked back out. Obviously walking backwards. When we've got over towards the motel section, Gork and I were having a little conversation with each other, and he said to me, what are we supposed to do? I don't know what to do. You know, he was he was just really scared at this point in time. And I was just as scared. And I was like, mate, well, first off, we're going to have to find some cover. We're going to keep an eye on all of these entrances and exits. And I'm just going to have to call someone in. I'm going to go and call the boss. But I said, mate, you're going to have to stand here. And he goes, but I don't want you to leave me. What if they come out? And I said, I get that, mate, but we can't keep an eye on all the entrances just here in this one spot. We can't see around the other side of the pub. I said, you're going to have to stay here. I said, you just hide behind that engine block. And if they come out and if you don't want to do anything, that's fine. That's fine. But you got to stay there. I said, mate, you can't let this control you. And meanwhile, I'm saying these words to him, but I'm thinking of these words to myself. I'm thinking, you know, I don't want this fear to overcome me. If I do, I lose control. I lose control of everything that I'm doing. And meanwhile, in the back of my mind, all I can think of is my daughter. You know, did I give her a cuddle? Did I say wonderful things to her today? Did I love her enough? Did I do something that made her smile today? Because this may be the last time that I see her. And then I'm like, okay, you can't think like that. You've got to switch that off. So I've told Gawk to wait there, and I've gone back around to the other, back through the drive-through and around to the Herbert Street side entrance. I've called the boss. He was going to come in, but of course that was going to take a bit of time, you know, at least 10 minutes. And then I've also contacted the security company, and there's a private security company in Gundawindi, and I've had a conversation with the owner who was on patrol and requested that he attend another side and just stayed down the street where he could just keep eyes on the pub just so we could see if someone was coming and going. Now, in the time that it took for the boss to get there, you know, we needed more staff. That's the hard thing about being out in the country. You go to a job, you have to have your smarts and your wits about you, because there's just either one or two of you. You don't have instant backup. Like, the closest backup that we had of any officers that were actually working on shift was Warwick, and that's 200 kilometres away. So obviously there's, you know, small stations in between, plus there's our station with lots more staff, but you have to rely on calling someone out, getting them, waking them up, them getting to the station, getting their kit on and coming out, you know, and that all takes time. And in that time, that gives you the time to stand there and watch, but also reflect of, bloody hell, this can go so bad. What am I going to do if they come out this way? Or, you know, what do I do if I'm faced with them? I've got a bit of cover here, but do I run? Do I hide? Do I not let them see me? Do I stand up and, you know, I'm a bit of a bulldog myself. I generally will say something before I don't. So would I stand up and say something? Would I put my gun, you know, on them and say, stop police or I'll shoot, you know, knowing that they could possibly have a shotgun on them or that they have a shotgun. So, you know, in that time that you're just trying to, the thing that you've got to do the most is just like really focus on the job and not focus on how you're feeling. Yeah, it's a hard one, and you've got to keep control. That's the main thing, keeping that control. So the boss attended, and in that time that it took him to get there and we had a brief conversation upon his arrival, we'd received further information at this stage from a staff member who was inside the pub that they believe that the offenders had actually fled on foot, a short time previously, and that it took them a while because they were so scared to double check that they had actually left and then to call police. So that was a bit of a savior for us. We were able to go in and clear the pub and then start gathering evidence. But, you know, at this point in time, I suppose it brought back some feelings for me from that shooting that I had been to. You know, that whole uncertainty and what would you do, and that flight or fight, the flight or fight really comes into it. And that has a huge part to play with PTSD, because when you're in that situation, you cannot, there's only two decisions that you can make, or, you know, two responses that you can have. And they're based on one thing, which is, are you going to fly? As in, are you going to do the runner, or are you going to stay? And are you going to confront that? And, you know, that brings all of its emotions with it. So I suppose I'll say that this job, even though it wasn't as confrontational, I didn't actually have any confrontation with the offenders. It was that initial fear and that initial thought and all the thoughts that were going through our minds. And being in that situation in the first place, it's real that someone is potentially coming at you with a shotgun. So that's probably where those feelings with the PTSD were resurfacing. It brought up all of that again. And so it might seem like, oh, at the end of the day, the offenders had fled on foot. But like I said, the information, that was not the information when we attended that job. And then all the other little factors that went with that. And for me, it's different being the female and having to take control of that situation. Like there's plenty of women in the world that, you know, take control of situations and are bosses and all that sort of stuff. And they do it well. They can handle stress. It's, you know, I'm not saying that I'm unique to someone else. But the thing was, is I'd had over 10 years of facing trauma on and off, and facing other people's trauma and witnessing their trauma. And so my cup at this point was getting more and more full. And I just didn't really deal, like it was afterwards, I didn't really deal with the thought of that very well, because I would think about that from time to time. And then I would think about if I'm in that situation again, which is normal, I suppose. But the fact that I had those feelings about my daughter and those feelings that I could possibly die on that night, I suppose you could say that this job wasn't a critical incident. You know, police weren't actually confronted with the offenders. The thing is less than 2 years prior to that job, another Queensland Police Service officer was shot and murdered when he responded to a similar type of job, being an armed hold-up in progress. Now, those thoughts are in the back of your mind. The information that we were provided was coming through all of the time, fairly up to date, that they were still inside and they had hostages. You know, I was pretty fearful for what could happen, and I also wanted to do the right thing. I didn't want to become a statistic, and I also didn't want to be scrutinized for doing a really bad job either. And I wanted to keep my partner and anyone there safe. So that's a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. And when you truly believe that that's what's happening, well, it was what happened. It was just in hindsight, you know, the offenders had left just prior to us arriving. And, you know, maybe that was a good thing about having those people, they weren't in custody, but those other people back at the station, you know, maybe that held us off that extra 2 minutes, and that was the 2 minutes that we didn't run into these offenders. I don't know, but the lasting effect for me was that I, again, was in fear of my life. I felt like I was the one who was taking control in this situation, and it was a lot on my shoulders. It was a lot to bear, and as a woman, like, I know I'm strong and I know that there's plenty of other strong women out there, but I didn't want to be strong. Sometimes you you want the male to take over. You want none of this to happen. And that's not through any fault at all of Gawk. He was much junior to me and he hadn't had much experience in these types of jobs. So of course he's going to be a bit, I don't really know what to do, what should we do? You're going to look to the senior officer, and that's fine. That's totally okay. I'm not being overcritical of him. The fact is, it's scary, and it's just the luck of the draw that nothing happens. And when it comes down to luck, like that can have a lasting effect on you. So in explaining a bit further and how this job would affect me long term, it finished on the night. That was it, done and dusted. Luckily, no major incident. It was the fact that those fearful feelings, they triggered feelings from my previous traumas, and that impacted on me. So I became more anxious. I would worry about things a bit more. I also, this sounds really silly, but it was anxiety and depression. So I also started to be in a more depressed state. And what that means for me is that I sort of withdrew a bit more from people. I became a bit more angry, like at jobs I had less tolerance with people. If they were annoying, I just would shut them off or cut them off really quickly. Other officers were like, are you all right? Yeah, I'm good. You know, and just that sort of thing, that was just getting worse and worse and worse for me because it had triggered emotions and feelings within me from prior jobs, like the job at Albany Creek. So those feelings come back, and that's how it affects you. It's not necessarily that the job was gory, it was brutal or anything like that. It just triggers that response back in you. And you don't realize at the time, but you start becoming more detached from people. You start worrying about things. Like after this job, I remember driving out of town somewhere, and I was going to a job, and a truck was coming the other way, and the second trailer sort of swung out a little bit just as I was going over a bridge. And now it almost pushed me into the side of the bridge. That worried me to the point where straight away I pulled the vehicle over. You know, I was a bit not nervous. I was just like, man, your life could be taken away so easily. Like I was just on edge about everything and I overreacted. I remember ringing the girls at the station and saying, if something happens to me, you girls would know to go and get my daughter from school, you know, and those sorts of things. I was just starting to become a little bit erratic and a little bit giving into more nervous energy. And the more that this happened and the further exposures to trauma that I had, the worse these feelings became, to a point where, you know, and I'll talk about this in another episode, but I was unable to control these feelings. And then that led to, me being very angry, and I couldn't deal with anxiety at all. So, that's the effect that a job like this has on you. It might not be some big thing at the time, but it's those lasting effects and it's those triggers. That's the important thing here. It triggers a response from you from before. And when you are unaware of that, it makes it very hard for you to then deal with the triggered emotion and then the new emotion on top of that. It like compounds it, and the pressure can start to become too much. So that's why I tell this story. Yeah. And I hope that, that anyone out there that is going through stress and or anxiety and having these feelings can resonate with that and start to understand their relationship, firstly with triggers and their relationship with how they emotionally respond to something. And I also hope that you are able to get help if you're not coping. Or if you are coping, that you have some strategies in place to help you to reduce those feelings, because I didn't. And over the next 2 years after that, it just got worse and worse and worse, to a point where I just fell in a heap. But yeah, that will be for another episode. That's where I'm going to leave this one today. So if you're not feeling well at the moment, or you know someone who's not feeling well, you know, start that conversation, and there is no shame in getting help.
Thank you for listening to When Blue Turns Black. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review, which helps others find the podcast, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on Vonnie and her journey, visit VonnieT-TheResilientWoman.com.